make the world. James Baldwin said it. We made this world we live in. We can make it again, but we can't remake it again by ourselves. It's time for us to come together. And when we all come together, what a day of justice it will be for Palestinians, for Jewish, for all of us, when we all come together. Hallelujah.
We're out of time. Today's show produced by me. That's Margaret Prescott. I'd like to thank the Sojourner Truth team, including our assistant producer, Ramiro Funes, and our engineer, Mr. T. Teddy Robinson. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can contact the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230 or go online to pacificaradioarchives.org. Remember to visit our website at sotrueradio.org and to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Our handle is at SoTrueRadio. Thank you for listening. This is your host, Margaret Prescott.
State of freedom. Hallelujah. Hallelujah.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. All you need is love.
Why do you love KBOO? Tell us what you most love about KBOO Community Radio, and we will use it on air during our next membership drive. Record a one-minute testimonial using the KBOO mobile app, or use a voice recording app on your phone and email it to info@kboo.org. That's info@kboo.org. Thank you. Love is all in it. Love is all in it. Love is all in it.
Love is all in it. In the aftermath of massive wildfires that burned across much of Western Oregon last summer, an incredible slew of post-fire logging proposals threatened to clear-cut over 10,000 acres of fire-impacted federal lands along the iconic Mackenzie and North Umpqua rivers. Tune into a special International Women's Day edition of Locus Focus, Monday, March 8th at 10 a.m., when we talk about the need to protect burned forests, not destroy them, with Samantha Krupp, community organizer working at the intersection of forest defense, climate justice, and feminism. Again, that's Monday, March 8th at 10 a.m. on KBOO Community Radio on International Women's Day.
I'm Brian Curtis.
I'm Wendy Rain, and this is Cool Solutions, stories of climate action from the bottom up. We tend to think of Americans as being highly mobile, well, not recently, but in general. But actually, 72% of us remain in or near the town we grew up in. These long-term relationships with place are causing a new kind of grief as climate change alters the seasons, traditions, and landscapes we thought we could count on. But these same connections are also leading some to stand up against tremendous odds to protect the land and communities they hold dear. Diane Wilson of Seadrift, Texas, and Sharon Levine of Welcome, Louisiana are two such women. These are their stories. Meet Diane.
I'm a fourth-generation fisherwoman on the Texas Gulf Coast. I've been on a shrimp boat probably since I was 8 years old. When you have a fishing family, the place that is home is the bay. You notice the currents, the color, what the fish are doing, how the dolphins are acting.
In the 1960s, fishermen began to notice something else.
Chemical plants all along the bay, Alcoa, Formosa, Union Carbide, Dow, DuPont, Interplast. When you would go past them at night, they looked like a fairyland.
By the late 1980s, it was plain to fishermen that something was wrong.
Local shrimping was beginning a decline from which it has yet to recover.
When my dad was shrimping, Seadrift probably had 120 boats. You could go out in August, shrimp till November, December, and you could make enough of a living that you could last the winter. Now the season is over with in several days. We might have 3 boats that go out fishing now. I was running a fish house because I wasn't making any money shrimping. One of the shrimpers that I took care of, I unloaded his shrimp, I gave him ice or fuel, wrote out his ticket at the end of the week. He had 3 different types of cancer, and one day he came in, he pitched a newspaper at me, and on the front of the paper were the headlines, our tiny little county. I mean, we were 18,000 in the entire county. We were number one in the nation for toxic waste. We had half the waste in the state of Texas.
And a lot of that waste was finding its way into the bay, which was the source of her livelihood.
I am basically an introvert. I am one of these people that doesn't like to speak. I don't like to be around crowds. I can remember when I was a child hiding under a bed to get away from people. It was probably a reason why I was so good on the bay, because there's a lot of solitude out there. But when I saw that article, I did something totally out of character. I walked down to City Hall and I said, I want to have a meeting about this information. By the next day, I had the city secretary down at the fish house. Nobody comes down to the fish house. Trust me, it's just fishermen with boots and smelling like shrimp. And here was the city secretary in this nice flowery dress, and she was like, Diane, you're going to have to not do this. And I'm like, well, okay, well, I'll take it to the cafeteria, the elementary school. And they're like, no, Diane, you have to take it entirely out. The bank president, who I had never talked to in my life, come out on the dock, and he said, Diane, are you trying to start a vigilante group to roast industry alive? Economic Development called my brothers, and they told him to make me shut up and not have this meeting. They were trying everything to shut me up on just having a meeting.
Undeterred, Diane invited elected officials.
The county commissioner, the county judge, the senator, mayor, and every one of them refused to come. The senator went on TV and said he was not going to that meeting.
Despite the lack of interest from politicians, there was good reason for a fishing town like Seadrift to be alarmed.
In our bay system, 5 companies discharge directly to the bays. You're looking at 25, 30 million gallons a day going into the estuaries, which is nursery areas, critical habitat of the crabs and the fish and the shrimp, and this is where their discharge is.
One of the major polluters was a plastics plant owned by a Taiwanese company called Formosa. When its wanton pollution sparked massive protests in Taiwan, the company decided to build plants in the U.S., and Texas bent over backwards to attract them.
Texas gave them anything they wanted. They said, we will make sure you don't have to do any permit hearings. We will make sure everything's expedited. They gave him millions upon millions in tax abatements.
And when it came to pollution, they looked the other way. Now the company wanted to expand, and the same agencies were prepared to quietly rubber stamp their permits.
Diane requested a public hearing. That brought more visitors to the docks.
I remember I had a bunch of fishermen sitting in my office, and they saw this black shiny car queued up to the fish house, and fishermen are real nervous about black shiny cars, and they thought it was the IRS, so they all climbed through the window and took off, and it was just the plant manager, and he had all these little papers, and he just wanted me to sign, just give up my request for their hearing. I had no support, I had no money, I had 5 kids. That's where it started.
Her fellow fishermen were reluctant to get involved.
It was a really tough time. Fishermen believe the last nail was being nailed in their coffin. And when I would go to them trying to get them to come to meetings or sign a petition, they're like, Diane, you can't fight City Hall.
The few allies Diane did have were either bought off or scared off by the company.
It's real typical Formosa. They go after your allies. And so they went after the foremost spokesperson for the fishermen in our county, and he happened to be my cousin, and they hired him as a consultant for $65,000 a year. And all he had to do was, when Formosa wanted to go before the commissioners or go before the state agencies, they wanted this fisherman to say, I represent fishermen in Calhoun County, and we like what Formosa's doing. And also, they wanted him to get information about what I was doing. Often he would come to the fish house and he'd say, Diane, give me some information to give to him. And I'd say, well, you tell me some information and I might tell you, you know. I got information on Formosa that way. They tended to go after anyone who was your ally.
Formosa intimidated the board members of Diane's fledgling organization by threatening them with lawsuits. When they all quit, she recruited new ones, poor divorced women with nothing to lose.
Formosa just came in without permits, violating law after law, and just started building.
Diane had a volunteer lawyer working on an injunction to stop construction.
Formosa went after my lawyer, and they literally took my lawyer. I was so despondent. It was like I couldn't stop fighting them, but I couldn't keep on.
She found herself in what she calls her dark night of the soul. So dark that it felt like the only way out was suicide.
I was going to go out like Marilyn Monroe. And I got two packages of sleeping pills, two bottles of alcohol. I took my boat far into the bay. Got on the stern as far to the end as I could, and I laid down and I was like, I'm gonna go to sleep and I'm gonna roll off into the water. That was how I wanted to go. But you know, the funny thing is, I could not go to sleep. I sat there and finally realized I was not gonna go to sleep and I was not gonna die. So I pulled up the anchor, took back home, and started all over again. That was my dark night of the soul.
Meanwhile, Formosa's expansion kept expanding.
They were going to be discharging 4 to 7 million gallons a day of toxic waste into Lavaca Bay.
By this time, Diane, who never went past high school, had taught herself to write her own legal briefs. She had an appeal on the water permit pending in federal court.
Legally, they could not discharge until the appellate judge responded.
Then Diane learned that the plant Formosa built without a permit was now discharging chemical waste without a permit.
The EPA said, well, it's really up to our discretion if we want to do it or not. When it comes down to the company with a lot of money, the law doesn't matter. And I was so outraged.
She decided to protest by sinking her shrimp boat on top of the plant's outfall pipe.
My cousin, who had been hired by Formosa to watch me, told Formosa. Formosa told the Coast Guard.
Before she got near the pipe, she was intercepted by 3 Coast Guard boats.
They had these huge microphones, and they said I was a terrorist on the high seas, and I was going to the jail for 19 years. They tied my boat with 10 or 11 ropes, and I was tied, lassoed into my cabin.
That was finally too much for the other fishermen.
I heard this noise, and I looked out the window, and all of these shrimpers, they went out in the middle of the bay and did a demonstration. They had their hands out the window in this fist of defiance and rebellion. It was unbelievable.
The coverage of that protest by big city media so embarrassed Formosa that they agreed to recycle their waste instead of dumping it into the bay, at least on paper. But workers at the plant told Diane a different story.
This is what they do. They're like, Diane, I'm going to tell you something, but I don't want you to use my name. And don't ask me to say it to anybody else but you.
Dale Jurassic, a wastewater foreman at Formosa, arranged to meet her at a bar 40 miles out of town to tell her how supervisors instructed him to dilute samples of discharge water before sending them to the lab, and about millions of plastic pellets being washed into the bay. He tried to blow the whistle. He even called the FBI.
the FBI took a picture of it, and they never did anything with it. Absolutely nothing.
That's when Diane, Dale, and a few other Formosa workers finally took things into their own hands and started collecting the discharged plastic pellets, also known as nurdles.
We had to collect because the EPA wasn't doing anything. The state wasn't doing anything. We would use these little nets you use when you got an aquarium. And eventually there were so many of them, we were using pool nets. You would put them in these little, irony of it, were in these little plastic sandwich bags. Sometimes they were quart bags. Sometimes they were gallon bags. Sometimes they were trash can fulls, bucket fulls. The workers were afraid of being caught with them, so I would stick them in my barn.
In 2016, with the help of Texas Rio Grande Legal Aid, Diane took Formosa to court for violating the Clean Water Act. Formosa claimed they were only discharging trace amounts of plastic. So when the case went before the judge, the nurdle collection came too.
Someone had a goat cart and they lended it to me, and we loaded 35 big plastic bins. And we took them to federal court in Victoria, and we hauled them straight into those, you know, where they got those little security booths. They nearly had freaked out when they saw us trying to load those bins in.
Then Formosa claimed that the plastic wasn't theirs, but data collected by hundreds of citizen scientists blew that fib out of the water.
Jace Tunnell is the reserve director of the Marine Science Institute at the University of Texas. His group studies how nurdles in the Gulf soak up toxic chemicals.
We're looking at PCBs, PAHs, DDTs, you know, all those acronyms you hear about that define harmful chemicals that absorb into those plastics.
Tiny pieces of this contaminated plastic get eaten by marine life, affecting everything from feeding to reproduction, and work their way up the food chain to people.
So Jace was concerned in the fall of 2018 when he found oodles of nurdles washed up on one of his reserve's beaches.
There were so many of them that I did a post on social media, and immediately somebody said, you need to call the Coast Guard. They ended up calling the state agency. And so the next day I met the state agency out at the beach, called me a couple days later and said they weren't going to pursue it because they thought it was a spill from offshore or from another country.
Jace wanted to know how far and how fast those nurdles on the beach could travel, so he started a Facebook page to recruit some volunteers.
We were looking at this small stretch of beach that's about 40 miles long, so we figured we needed 4 to 5 volunteers to help us out.
Within a few days, they had over 300.
And it wasn't just on that 40-mile stretch of beach. It was every state in the U.S. on the Gulf Coast, plus organizations and universities down into Mexico.
They called themselves the Nurdle Patrol. The methodology is simple. Once you find your first nurdle, set a timer for 10 minutes, and then see how many you collect before it goes off.
That way we can compare concentrations from one location to the next.
And lo and behold,
these aren't spills that are happening in another country. It's not from offshore. We're finding the highest concentrations way up in the bay systems, where the highest concentrations of plastic manufacturing sites are.
That convinced the judge that Diane's bins of nurdles were Formosa's smoking gun.
And we won, believe it or not. I've never saw anything like that in my life.
The judge found that Formosa was a serial offender for its years of violating the Clean Water Act and ordered them to pay $50 million, the highest penalty ever imposed in a clean water citizen action suit.
The $50 million will go toward restoring the bay, a sustainable fisheries cooperative, research on the health of the estuary and marine microplastics, including the Nurdle Patrol, and environmental education of the next generation. Formosa's Point Comfort plant is just one of hundreds of petrochemical plants that have been built or dramatically expanded over the last decade or are slated for construction. Now we're moving on to St. James, Louisiana, where people are fighting the company's plans to build one of the largest petrochemical plants in the world.
This place was so beautiful at one time. I would travel, go on vacation, and I always wanted to come back to St. James. I never seen anywhere in this world that I wanted to live but St. James. And now the industry have taken part of St. James away from us, and we want it back.
That's Sharon Levine, founder and president of Rise St. James, a local group fighting to stop the Formosa plant.
My daughter called me and told me that the governor was in St. James Parish announcing the approval of a $9.4 billion industry. That's how I found out. When I went home that evening, I turned on the news and I saw for myself the elected officials, like our representative, our senator that represents St. James Parish, and some of the parish council members and the parish president. They were there celebrating with the governor.
St. James Parish is one of the Louisiana counties. They're called parishes here, along a stretch of the Mississippi River called Cancer Alley. This 80-mile corridor between Baton Rouge and New Orleans hosts 200 petrochemical plants and is one of the most polluted regions in the U.S.
If the Formosa complex, which bears the Orwellian title, the Sunshine Project, is allowed to be built, it would be one of the largest polluters of carcinogenic benzene and ethylene oxide in the nation and would add thousands of tons of soot and ozone to already polluted air.
It would be too much toxic in the air for us to breathe. We will not live. That's why I'm fighting for my life and the life of my community.
Formosa didn't land in Sharon's backyard by accident. Ann Rolfes is the founder and director of the Louisiana Bucket Brigade, a group that's been helping communities like Sharon's fight polluting industries for 20 years.
St. James Parish as a whole is 50-50 black and white. That seems like there's integration. But if you look more closely, the districts are actually segregated. Fundamentally, the parish has what amounts to a racial cleansing document.
It's called zoning. In 2014, shortly after turning down two petrochemical plants in a predominantly white district, the parish quietly opened two predominantly black residential districts to industrial development.
They did it right under our nose.
Within a year, eight new plants came in, and Sharon watched verdant fields turn into a noxious industrial wasteland.
And as tax revenues from industry rose, the proceeds went disproportionately to the white communities, while the black communities suffered systematic disinvestment.
It was a bigger community at one time. Yes, it was. They sold our grocery stores. They closed our post office. They sold our high school and brought in industry.
Now, the predominantly black 4th and 5th districts have 21 large petrochemical plants and refineries. Air pollution has increased 600%, and residents of nearby towns like Welcome, 97% black, and St. James, 98% black, are getting sick.
So many of my friends are sick with cancer and other problems.
Rise St. James is only 2 years old, and two of its 20 members have already passed away.
They were the two that was with me on the first meeting that I had at my house. They were the first two sitting in my den, and they're gone.
Another Rise St. James member, Myrtle Felton, spoke during a 2019 march from New Orleans to Baton Rouge.
My name is Myrtle Felton. I'm a resident of St. James Parish. I've lived there all my life. I've seen businesses closed, banks closed, school closed, post office closed. We have nothing in Ford District but chemical plants.
She told about a traumatic four-month period in her life when she lost four family members, one after the other, to pollution-related diseases.
I never thought that chemical plants would cause that much damage to a family. And things are getting worse. They promise jobs that our people don't get.
That's right. That's
all
right.
We get is debt, sickness. It's just devastating to have to live here, and it's like nobody cares. You know, nobody cares about nothing when it comes down to our community.
Even though the 14 plants in Formosa's mega complex would exacerbate pollution and more than double the cancer risk for nearby residents, the Louisiana Department of Environmental Quality approved their air permits. When Rise St. James took the permitting agencies to court and Louisiana's Democratic governor defended them, Reverend Dr. William Barber of the Poor People's Campaign had this to say.
If he supports Formosa and people die, he's just as guilty as that cop that put his knee on George Floyd and strangled him. Because we can't just be moved when people die on camera. People are dying on cancer. I've been there. I've seen the billion-gallon containers that hold all of this poison water that people are worried now if the right storm comes along, if it will burst, and what it could do if it contaminated the river upstream and downstream. I've been there, I've seen the people, and they've decided that they're not just gonna die quiet anymore. They're gonna fight.
Sharon started out by going to local community groups.
I asked them, what are we gonna do about Formosa? And they said, There's nothing we could do about it because the governor approved it. That didn't set good with me in my mind. I was depressed. I was crying. I was so hurt because I thought I had to leave. And I just couldn't leave the place where I was raised. I spoke to God and he told me to fight. And that's what put the spark in me to want to fight this. Because if we don't fight it, we're not going to live.
So she quit her job as a special education teacher to form a new group, Rise St. James. And as Diane found in Seadrift, it's been hard to get local residents on board.
Me and my organization tried to give them information. Some of them believe and some of them don't. But it's hard to believe your own public officials know that these chemicals will kill us and they won't make us aware. It hurts so bad to know that.
They've done marches, spoken out at public meetings, put ads in the paper, and written letters to the editor. But many local people are afraid to speak out.
Their children and grandchildren that's working in industry, they don't want me to put a sign in their yards.
The group has found regional and national allies. The Louisiana Bucket Brigade got its name from the buckets they once used to help people in polluted areas capture air samples. Director Ann Rolfes says they've pretty much abandoned that tactic.
It's like the Wizard of Oz when the wizard says, "Bring me the witch's broom." The state will say, "Prove to us the air is polluted." We do it, we bring it to them, and they still do nothing. I'm not wasting my time bringing the broom when it will bring forth zero action.
Now the Bucket Brigade's major tool is media to amplify the voices of local residents and expose the shady dealings of state regulators to the light of day. The David versus Goliath battle against Formosa has gotten national coverage. When Biden speaks about environmental justice, he calls out St. James by name.
Rise St. James and the Bucket Brigade also filed a lawsuit contesting permits issued by the Army Corps of Engineers.
It's really illuminating to read that legal brief. My jaw was on the floor. As bad as I know our regulatory bodies can be, and as rotten as I know Formosa Plastics is, it's a whole nother experience to read these legal briefs and have it explained about just how bad it is. The Army Corps didn't even require an environmental impact statement, saying it was insignificant. Now, how the hell can that be true when it would be one of the largest plastics plants in the world? They didn't consider the burden on the Black community. They didn't consider the destruction of wetlands. We have this coastal zone that's fragile. You know, Louisiana is sinking into the sea. Every year, there's another hurricane that washes off four of our shores. The way that climate change manifests here is through flooding. And yet, the Army Corps of Engineers is going to give the green light and permit to the largest new source of greenhouse gases in the whole country.
The Corps permit would allow disruption of slave graveyards, something Formosa knew about but failed to disclose.
If they had their way, they would be building on top of these graves and nobody would ever know.
In response to that lawsuit, the Army Corps suspended Formosa's permit for reevaluation. And a judge, citing systemic racism, also sent Formosa's air permits back to the state for review. Delia Creamer of the Center for Biological Diversity, which litigates on the group's behalf, describes the overall strategy.
It's a two-part strategy, running the lawsuit and fighting them on the legal battles, and then using that delay. We've already delayed this project significantly. They were supposed to be online producing plastic right now. And then in the meantime, as we're delaying, we're changing the public opinion and building people power.
A delay is just a temporary reprieve.
Our president and commander-in-chief has the power to make that permanent.
This is in Biden's court.
And in ours, as the people power, to make sure his decisions come down on the side of justice. Look for actions you can take at our website, cool-solutions.org. If President Biden does walk his talk on environmental justice and revokes the permit, this will be a victory for more than just St. James. Remember when the fishermen said, "You can't fight City Hall," and when Sharon's community organization said, "The governor approved it, there's nothing we can do"?
There's this idea that these big plants are a done deal or that you can't stop them. And I think with Formosa Plastics, we were really proving that notion wrong. In one corner, we have this huge company, Formosa. In another, we have a small Black community. The odds were against St. James, and they're not dead yet, but we surely have them on the ropes. When we beat Formosa, I think will be a shockwave that ripples, because it is one of the world's largest companies wanting to build one of the world's largest plastics plants in a historic Black community it would wipe that community off the face of the earth.
Anne and Sharon are optimistic that that's not going to happen and that St. James has better days ahead.
St. James is going to thrive. Once we stop Formosa, then we're going after the others that's poisoning my community. Then we're going to win.
I'm Wendy Ring.
And I'm Brian Curtis.
And you've been listening to Cool Solutions, Climate Action from the Bottom Up. Many thanks to our guests,
Diane Wilson, Jace Tunnell, Sharon Levine,
Ann Rolfes, and Delia Creamer. And to Lahar, Huma Huma, and Scott Holmes for our music.
Clean air is mine, clean air is mine, clean air today is mine. At Formosa, get me behind, clean air today is mine. Clean water is mine, clean water is mine, clean water today is mine. At Formosa, get me behind, clean water today is mine. Justice is mine. Justice is mine, justice today is mine. I told Formosa to get thee behind. Justice today.
Good morning. This is Disability Justice, an everyday pursuit and survival. Your host, John Griffiths.
And Dina Wilder, board operator.
And with me in the studio today is Jessica Bridges. And what is your title, Jessica?
Yeah, so I'm the Director of Member Development and Learning with L'Arche Portland.
What is the history of L'Arche?
There's kind of two parts to our history. The first part is like how we got to have a French name. So L'Arche is French for the ark, like Noah's ark, like the boat. And that is because we were founded originally in France in the 1960s. So a group of four men started living together. Three of them were people with disabilities who moved directly out of an institution. So our very initial founding was a movement to move people out of institutions. And then as other people saw kind of the beauty and also just that it worked, this like sharing life together in a regular old house in town and not an institution, more like a family or like housemates, other people wanted to start similar homes in other places. So it spread around the world. And then in Portland, the second part, our part for L'Arche Portland, we started in the 1980s. So a group of people started meeting together and kind of had a vision that looked something like L'Arche.
So you guys actually started before the brokerage system started?
I think so. When did the brokerage system start? You're talking about in Oregon specifically, right?
Yeah, I didn't think it started until the 90s or the aughts.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we've been around since 1987.
Whoa.
Yeah. Yeah, so before brokerages, and that's a part of why, like our two first homes, they're classified as adult foster care, because that was kind of the main option that seemed to, we didn't fit it well, but that was what seemed to fit out of the options. A group of people had a vision for like, you know, what if some people with and without disabilities live together, made and eat meals together, go on camping trips together. And so they started a house called Nehalem House. And then eventually it became a part of L'Arche.
Where is L'Arche now?
I mentioned that L'Arche spread kind of all over the world from that first community in France, including here. But we have about 150 communities in almost 40 countries. So that's one thing about where L'Arche is now. And then in Portland, we have three homes, two on the east side, one on the west side in Beaverton. And then also monthly community events. That's kind of been a newer development for us too. That's a big part of our community.
Do the 40 different countries of L'Arche ever interact with each other? Do you have like a, maybe a global conference or anything like that?
Yeah, we do. Yeah, every 4 or 5 years, there's an assembly of the whole L'Arche International Federation. So every, like, maybe not every community, but every region will at least send some representatives. And I got to experience that actually in Atlanta when I was a part of L'Arche Atlanta before. And my first week in Atlanta, we hadn't even started our first house, but we had the International Assembly in Atlanta, and I got to meet people from all around the world. It was really cool.
Cool. Yeah, that sounds really nice. So what are L'Arche's goals for the future?
We do a fair bit of thinking about what are our goals. Like every few years, we really do an in-depth kind of listening process with everyone in the community. So we recently kind of did some reassessing of our community goals. And the top three were, the very top one was centering people with intellectual and developmental disabilities in our decision-making processes and structures, because we always have room to grow in doing that. So we're really prioritizing that. The second one was serving more people. So right now, as far as services and supports that we offer, it's just in two homes on the east side. And we've been approved, but still figuring out the infrastructure for offering community living support, CLS. So are you familiar with CLS?
I am not familiar what community living supports is. Could you explain that?
So community living supports is basically where there's a matching of people with disabilities who are hiring their support workers. And community living supports is kind of the category of funding that makes that possible. Similar to supported living or some other categories that kind of work through brokerages often.
If I understand that correctly, a client would hire a company who hires individuals who are responsible for that client for either 24/7 care or for, 4 hours or 2 hours or anywhere from
whatever the need is.
Anywhere what the need is. But doesn't that also mean that the client can only work with caregivers from that particular company? Like if you're doing supported living through L'Arche, you can only work with L'Arche people. You can't work with people who aren't a part of the L'Arche corporation or company or whatever, right?
That's a good question. And so at Gabriel House, our newest house in Beaverton, because we don't have anything, L'Arche doesn't have anything to do with people's caregiving support. I don't actually know all the ins and outs, but I do know that some of the members with disabilities at Gabriel House have typically actually a couple of different agencies that they have workers through. So often it's kind of ends up being parsed out as this agency supports this person with more home-based things, that the cooking and cleaning, and then this other agency tends to do the kind of out in the community kind of stuff. So I'm not sure if what they have is CLS, but I know at least from knowing Gabriel House members that a number of them have some options where they're able to contract with a few different agencies.
I must admit, I didn't make the connection that they're actually just roommates.
Yeah, Gabriel House, that's kind of the new thing that we're trying is what would it be like if housemates don't have this paid relationship with each other? Our East Side homes still are that, where if you're a live-in member without an intellectual disability, then that's part of the deal is that it's an employment thing and a housemate thing. So people who live together do have that paid relationship on the East Side in our two East Side homes. We're doing what we've done in the past for the past 30 years, and we're doing kind of a new thing in Beaverton.
How is L'Arche different from the typical foster group homes?
Yeah, it's a great question. We have three homes, and two of them I mentioned are actually classified as adult foster care. And like I said, we don't always fit in those boxes super well, but that's the regulations that we're upheld to. The way that I would say our two Eastside homes differ from a typical foster or group home is that, like, one thing is that we really focus on building community beyond our homes. So it isn't just about these homes. It's about something bigger. It's about all of our friends and volunteers and partners that were part of something bigger, not just these homes. And then that also includes, like, our international movement that we're a part of, that we sometimes go to gatherings, or we've been having, like, some Zoom calls with friends in Tacoma or Washington, D.C. or other places. And one other thing is also that we spiritual life is a part of kind of focuses of our community.
When you say spiritual life, are you talking about religion?
That's a good question. Yeah. And, you know, that's also a good question that we're asking ourselves all the time. And that's actually, like, that was the goal that I actually didn't mention, is clarifying our spiritual identity to be in line with today's members is another big goal of ours. An aspect that I didn't mention about the very first L'Arche community in France was that it was a Catholic layperson that helped start that. So there was a lot of Catholics there at the beginning. But as L'Arche has spread around the world, every community kind of takes on the shape of its own members. Some places that meant it became ecumenical, so a number of different kind of Christian, Catholic, and Protestants together. In some places, like especially in India, like, there are communities where the spiritual life is a mix of Christian and Hindu and Muslim practices, or that all of those people find a way to pray together. And in Portland, we also have Catholic roots. The Archdiocese of Portland helped start the very beginning, the Halem House, before we were even L'Arche. But as we've evolved, we are a mix of Christian folks, and right now, folks who are Jewish, Buddhist, people who are kind of like, oh, what is religion? What is spirituality? I'm not sure about that for myself. So we have quite a mix. When we talk about L'Arche spirituality, we often talk about our pillars of L'Arche spirituality, which are kind of able to cut through all of that, like grief and celebration and joy and suffering. So those are kind of what we kind of hang our head on, is those spiritual pillars that kind of cut across all traditions.
And would you have any, like, people who don't conform to the, you know, God-based faith?
Yeah, we're open to anyone and everyone. And I know I get really excited about kind of where are people at, and how can we nurture and make space for each person? And that's what we ask of any new member of community, is that they're open to being around and hearing about other people's faith or spirituality or non-spirituality, their reflective practices or meaning-making practices, and that as they feel comfortable, that they might also offer that from themselves and you know, even kind of be a leader in that way.
That's fascinating. Are you guys also open to any of the other things, like gender identity differences or sexual orientation differences or differences in there's no two humans on the planet who are entirely alike.
Totally. Yeah.
So I was just wondering if you're open to all of that as well.
Yeah. A part of our mission is that we celebrate the unique value of each person. And so we hope to embrace and celebrate all of that diversity and uniqueness. And we're trying to be better at that. As far as on, like, gender identity and sexual identity, we had our first Pride event this past summer during Pride Month. So that was super fun. We hadn't done that before. And we had people from all over the world, from other L'Arche communities too. So, and right now, I'll mention this when we talk about events, but we right now have a grant to be kind of bolstering, supporting our diversity, equity, and inclusion practices in learning. And so we have the speaker series that we're doing right now. I would say around queerness and spirituality is our next speaker series. And that's probably our sweet spot of, like, where we've been most comfortable exploring diversity and already have that some way in our community. But, like, we've typically been a very white organization and community, so, like, that's probably our real growing edge. So that's what I say in terms of we're always trying to do better in how we embrace difference.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And I'm realizing that you were saying that sharing about Gabriel House might also, we kind of went on spiritual life, but how does L'Arche differ from a typical foster group home?
Yes.
Do you want to share about how Gabriel House is even more different from?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So I mentioned like our two Eastside homes, even though they are classified as adult foster care homes, they are different from typical homes in a lot of ways. Gabriel House is our newest house in Beaverton, and it's just over a year old. And the way that it is very different from a typical foster group home is that it's not a licensed house in any kind of way. It's not a regulated home of any sort. So it's really an invitation for people with and without intellectual disabilities to share life together and without paid relationship with each other, so that if a person needs some paid support, they contract with non-L'Arche entities to do that. And so that's, like we said, a grand experiment for us. And
okay.
About that.
Yeah, it's so fascinating to learn about L'Arche. You know, I had some ideas I honestly did not know until you started explaining it to me. Thank you. So what is your role at L'Arche?
So I mentioned my title is Director of Member Development and Learning. So there are two kind of main areas of our work at L'Arche Portland that I support. One, like the learning part of my role, is around what we call like formation and retreats. So I help plan things like community-wide retreats and weekly professional development for our assistants, who are like our staff. And I keep an eye out for like non-L'Arche opportunities that other people might be offering that people could plug in with. So that's kind of like the learning part. And then the other part of my role is around building community on the west side of town. So for the past 30 plus years, we've mostly had two homes on the east side of town in Montevilla. And then in the past few years, we've started having monthly community events beyond our homes. And then we started this new house in Beaverton. So that's been a big part of my role.
And when you say a new house in Beaverton and a big part of your role, so a part of your role, was it to actually find the house and then find some way of, like, I'm not certain how L'Arche goes about this. I mean, are you renting the house, or is L'Arche leasing the house, or is L'Arche actually purchasing the home?
Good question. Yeah, L'Arche had purchased the house before they hired me. But then they realized, like, oh, we need someone who can focus on figuring out what exactly kind of people do we want to live in this house and finding the exact, you know, people. So I helped to like lead our discernment team to welcome people to apply, like creating the application, reading through people's applications and interviewing them and welcoming new people. So the house itself was already, we purchased it, yeah. We purchased it from a church below market rate. They gave us a really good deal on it. So, and we were in a place to be able to buy a house.
And so that does bring up another interesting question is obviously the church was willing to help you out by significantly, by lowering the market rate and giving you a much lower price. But at the same time, do you have to like do some fundraising to get to that below market price? I mean, how does that work for L'Arche? I mean, I've never been to a fundraising L'Arche event, so I'm not certain if you'll hold one annually or what.
That's one way that we're also different from like a typical foster group home, is that because our vision is a bit bigger than just our homes, and we want to be able to, yeah, invest in like buying a house, and we want to invest in our assistants with professional development, things like that. We actually, I'm not in the fundraising part of the team, but I want to say that our budget is like half like government funding that's attached to the caregiving support, Medicaid funds, that kind of thing. And then about half of our budget is fundraised. And that is some like small and big donors and some grants and things like that. We do have an annual fundraising event in every fall, and we have a Christmas tree sale, a tree lot that is a big fundraiser for us. So those are a couple of the ways that we raise money.
So what events does L'Arche have for the public?
Yeah, there are three main types of events that we have on a regular basis. One is the speaker series that I mentioned earlier called Welcoming Our Differences, and it's a three-part series. The next one will be March 11th. It'll be the final one, and it's actually an intro to disability justice. What a great connection. Uh-huh. And it's in the evening on Thursday, March 11th from 5:30 to 7:30 p.m. on Zoom.
Is that anything like trying to teach the LARCH members on how to get involved in advocacy efforts, all that great political difficulties one has to go through to advocate for one's rights or to advocate for one's continued survival?
Mm-hmm. Which is like exactly what your show was about. I think it'll probably hit some on the political advocacy. It's actually one of your previous guests on the show, Rebel Sydney Black, is going to be our facilitator. So if you have a sense for the kind of framing of disability justice that they bring, that's what it'll be. But I think it would probably be thinking of advocacy, you know, pretty broadly, including political, but other things too.
Yeah, it does sound like Sydney is just trying to grow their group bigger and bigger and get more people on board, which always helps out, because the more you have, the more politicians listen to you.
So that's the speaker series. The last one will be in March. Maybe we'll do something similar again in the future. And then LARCH at Home has been one of our monthly community events during COVID. We used to have like an event on the east side and an event on the west side every month, but we're doing it all together on Zoom. So LARCH at Home happens the first Thursday of each month at 6 p.m.
And what is LARCH at Home? I mean,
what do we do?
Yeah.
Every month we celebrate birthdays. So if you have a birthday that month, we will sing to you. It's probably a little less obvious on Zoom than when we're in person. But we sing to each other, and if we have like new members of the community, we do kind of official welcomes of new people in the community. Last night was our last one that I went to, and we had a scavenger hunt. So usually some sort of kind of like fun activity or discussion.
Hmm.
Yeah, pretty light, pretty easy to drop in on. LARCH at UP is our other monthly community event. It's a partnership with University of Portland. College students there are connecting with adults with intellectual disabilities every month in that community event. And that is, as far as how to find the Zoom link, you do need to email our Director of Community Life, Allison Krieger, to get the Zoom link for that one.
It is nice to see that LARCH is doing its best to integrate the disability community with the larger community.
Yeah.
So, Jessica, how are you preventing LARCH from being another form of institution?
Like I mentioned, we were originally founded as a response to institutionalization, a move away from that. But as we know, history can repeat itself if we're not proactive. A few things. One, I mentioned how Gabriel House is not a licensed house at all. That I would say that's one big way that we are trying out new models that are less and less kind of institutional feeling. And that is like one concrete example of the ways that we're always trying to build up unpaid relationships. So natural support relationships, our friends and volunteers, that's what LARCH is really about. We do offer paid services in some of our homes, and eventually we want to, you know, be supporting people who live in their own home. But that's one way that we come into relationship with people, and we also want to be in unpaid relationships and supporting that. So I think that's one big way. And then in all areas of our community, I think we really always strive to balance a really vibrant person-centered approach with also invitation to community. You know, the person-centered piece is kind of the response to institutionalization, and the invitation to community is the response to sometimes the isolation that can happen both in institutions and, you know, maybe someone just living in a studio apartment. Like I mentioned, our mission is that we celebrate the unique value of each person. That's one part of our mission. And we also emphasize our need for one another. So that really celebrating the individual and that we're in community. That's kind of like more the mission part, but that's kind of helps us maybe stay on course.
Know of quite a few people who went from their parents' home to a group home and got stuck in the group home, even though their eventual goal was to get out and live on their own.
I think if someone has named a goal of not wanting to live at large for a super long time, and they and there's a particular vision for moving out of L'Arche, we would definitely want to support whatever that process is. I think probably more and more that will become a more common experience at Gabriel House. I have less of a sense of that being kind of the vision for a number of people on the in our East Side home. We want long-term relationships, whether that means you're living in a L'Arche house for a really long time or you move out, we still want to be in community with you. But there's less of a built-in sense that this is a temporary place. Does that make sense? So
yeah.
We want it to be temporary if you want it to be temporary. We want it to be long-term if you want it to be long-term.
So besides events, are there any other ways that people can connect with L'Arche?
Yeah, there are a few other ways. One way is that if you have a group, like a school group or a church or other spiritual community group that's interested in learning about L'Arche or intentional community or disabilities, you can reach out to us. And we love speaking and sharing about ourselves with groups.
Is it limited to just teaching and spirituality groups? Can you also like go to brokerages and county case managements and conferences of all kinds like TASH and stuff like that?
That all sounds great. I'm glad you named that. We just don't get as many of those invitations, I feel like. So yes, all of the above. We love building partnerships in that way. Yeah, so that's one thing. And then I mentioned we're all about these like volunteer and friend relationships. So if you are interested in like, you know, in these days that we're on Zoom a lot, like doing some origami over Zoom with someone from one of our homes or, you know, sharing a gift in that kind of way. And that's really where relationships are built in person too, is where we have these shared interests, you know, maybe sharing some music or anything like that. You can reach out to me via email.
So how do we get a hold of L'Arche and you?
You can see a lot of things about our events and contact info for everyone on our leadership team on our website. So that is www.larcheportland.org. And again, this is tricky. So it's L-A-R-C-H-E dash Portland spelled out .org. So that's our website. And then social media is another great way to stay plugged in with us. We're on Facebook and Instagram, so you can find us there. And then my email address is Jessica, and that's J-E-S-S-I-C-A @ LarchePortland.org, so spelled out how I spelled it earlier. You can also reach out by phone, 503-251-6901. My extension is 707, or you can leave a message or, you know, talk to the main person answering.
Jessica, it's been wonderful to have you in the studio. By the way, I'm not actually in the studio. That's why you'll kind of hear some hearing noises around me, is because me and Jessica are actually being recorded over Zoom due to the pandemic. So, but I'm saying inside the studio because trying to pretend like we're inside the studio.
The virtual studio.
Yeah, the virtual studio. We're inside a virtual studio. And I would very much like to thank you and hope that we can have you again as a guest on our radio show to, you know, check in with you on the future about, you know, what has changed in L'Arche, perhaps, you know, some time down the line.
That would be great. Thank you so much, John. This is a lovely opportunity and a lovely conversation.
That's the end of Disability Justice. since we cannot be fully aware of everybody's difficulties within the community, we would really like it if you would send us your email, disabilityjustice@kbu.org.
Also, we're always looking for fun, inexpensive things to do out in the community. Go to disabilityjustice@kboo.org to contact us and give us your ideas.
Portland.
KBOO is hiring a membership director. Our membership director maintains relationships with KBOO members and listeners, create a process to meet or exceed fundraising goals, and manage the membership database. For a complete job description and instructions on how to apply, visit kboo.fm/employment.